KSDP 830 AM, Sandpoint, K201DA, King Cove, KFPS, False Pass.
process to avoid a filibuster. The Pentagon has accepted the luxury $400 million Boeing jet from Qatar, which will eventually be used as a new Air Force One if it's retrofitted in time. Ethics experts have raised concerns over the legality of the gifts, as well as the cost of retrofitting the plane, which could cost upwards of $1 billion. The plane will eventually be transferred to Trump's presidential library, where he continued using it after leaving office. Senate Republicans on Wednesday blocked a bill authored by Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer that would have barred the Pentagon from spending any taxpayer money on the jet. In other news from D.C., officials from the U.S. Institute for Peace returned to their offices Wednesday after a federal judge ruled the Trump administration engaged in a, quote, gross usurpation of power, unquote, when it took over the Independent Institute earlier this year and ejected its leaders as part of Elon Musk's rampage against federal agencies. Judge Beryl Howell declared the White House takeover null and void. Pakistan has blamed Indian terror proxies, they say, for an attack on a school bus in southwestern Balochistan province Wednesday, which killed at least 6 people, 3 of them children. India has rejected any involvement in the attack, which comes at a time of heightened tensions between the two countries. Just days earlier, a car bomb killed 4 more people in Balochistan. The region has seen years of bloody conflict between the Pakistani government and Baloch separatists. The father of 3 boys killed in Wednesday's school bus attack implored warring parties to halt the deadly attacks.
For God's sake, we are neither terrorists nor do we like terrorism. We are peace-loving people. For God's sake, forgive our children. We have left our region and homeland for you. What else can we do? You have targeted my innocent children. For God's sake, we have no other way. Have mercy on our situation.
In Britain, Leyla Swaif, the mother of the imprisoned British-Egyptian activist Ali Abdel Fattah, has resumed an almost total hunger strike to demand the release of her son. She spoke in front of the Prime Minister's residence at 10 Downing Street Tuesday as she applies pressure on the UK government to secure the freedom of her son, who's also on hunger strike in an Egyptian prison.
The Prime Minister made a promise to me and to Parliament to do all he could to free Ali. A few days ago, my daughter Mona received a truly humane letter from Mr. Starmer assuring all of my family of his continued support. But for Ala, sitting in prison, now on hunger strike, for 81 days since the 1st of March, nothing has changed.
Egyptian authorities have kept Ali Abdel Fattah behind bars for most of the last decade over his human rights advocacy. And the Justice Department is dismissing police reform and oversight agreements in Minneapolis and Louisville just days ahead of the 5-year anniversary of the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, May 25th, 2020. The consent decrees came in response to Floyd's murder, as well as the Louisville police killing of Breonna Taylor, March 13th, 2025, after federal investigations found patterns of unconstitutional and racist policing practices in both cities. The Trump administration disputed those findings and dismissed the consent decrees as federal micromanagement. The DOJ is also ending civil rights investigations into police departments in Memphis, Phoenix, Oklahoma City, Trenton, New Jersey, and Mount Vernon, New York. Both Minneapolis and Louisville, which are run by Democratic mayors, said they would nonetheless move ahead with the planned reforms. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. 2 staffers at the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. were shot dead last night outside the Capitol Jewish Museum. This is D.C. Police Chief Pamela Smith.
We believe the shooting was committed by a single suspect who is now in custody. Prior to the shooting, the suspect was observed pacing back and forth outside of the museum. He approached a group of 4 people, produced a handgun, and opened fire, striking both of our decedents. After the shooting, the suspect then entered the museum and was detained by event security. Once in handcuffs, the suspect identified where he discarded the weapon, and that weapon has been recovered, and he implied that he committed the offense.
Israel's foreign ministry identified the shooting victims as 30-year-old Yaron Lashinsky and Sarah Lynn Milgram. They both worked at the Israeli embassy and were about to be engaged. They'd been attending a private event at the Capital Jewish Museum. According to one of the organizers, the event focused on advancing humanitarian aid efforts for Gaza. Authorities arrested 30-year-old Elias Rodriguez of Chicago, who was filmed shouting in support of Palestinians as he was being detained.
The journalist Ken Klippenstein posted what is believed to be a manifesto by the alleged gunman, Elias Rodriguez. In the document, he praises Aaron Bushnell, the U.S. Air Force person who self-immolated last year in an act of protest outside the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. Rodriguez wrote, quote, Aaron Bushnell and others sacrificed themselves in the hopes of stopping the massacre, and the state works to make us feel their sacrifice was made in vain, that there is no hope in escalating for Gaza and no point in bringing the war home. We can't let them succeed. Their sacrifices were not made in vain.
We go now to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy, an award-winning Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, member of its editorial board. Gideon Levy's latest book is titled The Killing of Gaza, Reports on a Catastrophe. Thank you so much for being with us, Gideon. If you could first respond to the killing of these two staffers, a couple who walked outside of this American Jewish Committee event at the Jewish Museum in Washington last night.
I mean, this incident can be only condemned. Nothing that Israel is doing can justify such a murder. It was a murder. And unfortunately also, this kind of violence will not bring the Gaza war to its end. So it's tasteless, it's criminal, it's tragic. Two young people being murdered. It doesn't serve anything, and it should be condemned and not justified by anything. Nothing can justify it.
And Gideon, if you could just talk about what the preliminary response in Israel has been and whether you anticipate anything happening as a direct consequence of this murder?
No, I don't expect anything in particular connected with this murder. But the general atmosphere in Israel starts to be realizing that because of the war in Gaza, Israel is turning into a pariah state. People start to digest it, start to understand that there will be a price for all the crimes, for the mass killing, for the destruction. And the longer this war will go on, the more damage will be made also to Israel. First, the main damage is obviously to the real direct victims in Gaza. But also Israel is going to pay a price for running this war for so long with so little justification, legitimacy, or purpose.
Well, Gideon, if you could talk about your latest column, Israel's military leaders are not only obeying orders, they could have stopped the Gaza massacre. If you could elaborate on what you say in the piece.
Sure. There is a tendency mainly among my friends in the Zionist left or in the central left of Israel to put everything on the shoulders of the government, which is right to do, but to give some immunity to the army, as if the army is still the old holy cow of Israel. I cannot accept it, because finally the children, almost 1,000 babies, can you imagine yourself, almost 1,000 babies in 19 months, not to speak about the 17,000 children. They were killed by soldiers. They were killed by pilots. They were killed by people who have to take accountability for this. Yes, the government decides about the policy, and the government should be blamed for such a policy. But by the end of the day, we cannot say it's only the government, because the army did it. There are almost no refuseniks in this war, which is quite surprising. There are some, but very few, and for sure not public ones. And all the others are committing a criminal policy, a policy with a black flag on it. a policy which is very clear, does not meet any of the articles of the international law. And therefore, to say we don't attack the army, we don't criticize the army, it's only the government, is really doing our life too easy. Yes, the army is very popular in Israel. We have to break this militarism once and for all and say, yes, the government is to be blamed, but so does the army. Everyone who took part in this bloodbath should be taken accountable.
Gideon Levy, we thank you so much for being with us. So we hope to get back to you next week. Apparently, the Israeli government is going to hold a conference next week in Jerusalem on anti-Semitism, attended by ministers from member states of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. This, as the opposition Israel Democratic Party head, Yair Golan, condemns the Netanyahu government's siege of Gaza during an interview with Israeli public radio, saying, quote, Israel's on its way to becoming a pariah state among nations like South Africa was if we don't return to acting like a sane country. And a sane country doesn't wage war against civilians, does not kill babies as a hobby, and does not give itself the aim of expelling population. It's, again, those the words of Yair Golan, who is with the opposition Israel Democratic Party. We're going to turn right now to Gaza. Go directly to Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Israel's military has intensified its attacks on the Gaza Strip, killing at least 51 Palestinians since dawn. Gaza's health ministry reports Israel bombed three electric power generators and fuel storage tanks at the besieged Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza. They've also surrounded Gaza's Al-Auda hospital. With Israel's latest attacks, only 19 of Gaza's 38 hospitals are still operating, albeit at severely limited capacity.
We go now to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, where we're joined by Dr. Victoria Rose, a British senior plastic and reconstructive surgeon with the National Health Service. She's been on three medical missions to Gaza since October 2023. We're talking to her on the day this week after it's been announced by Britain that they're going to pause trade talks with Israel, given what is happening in Gaza right now. Dr. Victoria Rose, tell us what's happening there. What are you finding?
So we arrived about we arrived on the 13th of May, and we've been working at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis since the 15th. As you said, it's not my first trip, so there's some comparisons here, but the main thing that's different really is the state of the population. I mean, it's very clear that we're dealing with a completely different patient population now. These people haven't had any food in since the 2nd of March. They are malnourished. The children are particularly taking the brunt of this. They are all a lot shorter than their Western counterparts. That's always been a problem from their chronic malnutrition. But they are very, very thin. We are having a lot of problems with wound healing, because obviously if you're not getting enough nutrients and vitamins, your cells are not turning over in a timely fashion and you can't heal your wounds. On top of that, we are having dire problems with infection. This is related to the malnutrition, but also related to the situation that the people are in. They are living in tents, it's dirty. We're running out of clean water. Israel have stopped the vaccination programs. It's the worst it's ever been.
And Dr. Rose, if you could say, you know, what kinds of injuries are you seeing most often, and particularly on children?
So they're all blast and bomb injuries. And there's a couple of, there's two types of wounds that you see from a bomb going off or an explosion. The first is a burn from the heat of the explosion, and we're seeing some huge burns, 40, 50% burns in children, the sort of burns that are very rarely survivable in the UK when we have all of our intensive care colleagues around us and specialist hospitals. We still have problems supporting children with this size burn in the UK. So you can imagine what that burn is like over here. The other injuries that we're seeing are due to the penetration of the missiles. So what happens in a blast is whatever is around you, either the local masonry or a car or whatever was blown up with you, is ejected at a very high speed and it hits the civilians like a missile. This will either penetrate the head, chest or abdomen, and if it does that, you're unlikely to survive. If it penetrates a limb, you're likely to survive and you'll be brought to a hospital. What we're seeing is traumatic amputations of hands, fingers, feet, toes, legs, arms. And what isn't amputated is severely destructed. So we are trying to piece together bones, patch missing bits of skin, nerves are damaged, really, really severe injuries.
So, Dr. Rose, you're describing these severe injuries on a large number of children, but you're also working with very little medicine. If you could, explain how you're doing this surgical work with access to such few anesthetics.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing that we're low on at the moment is antibiotics. We ran out of Augmentin or Coamoxiclav, which is the most standard antibiotic that we use in these type of injuries. And we're down to a very weaker substitute, ceftriaxone, which we don't actually use in the UK now. And that's our real problem, is that we're not giving adequate antibiotics to these people. We just don't have them.
And Dr. Rose, Nasser Hospital is not far from the fighting. Could you talk about your concerns about a possible forced evacuation, and if such were to occur, where the patients at Nasser would go?
Yeah, we're checking the IDF website, which is idf.il, and if you're in Gaza, it picks up your location immediately, and they've gridded the entirety of the strip. We are basically a grid away from the active fighting, so about four streets, about a K and a half from the evacuation zone. We had dire problems on Tuesday when that zone was announced, in that quite a lot of my team had to leave me to go and evacuate their families. My anaesthetist today, on Tuesday, walked 20K with his 5, 6 and 8-year-old. To evacuate them from where they lived in East Khan Yunis into Almawasi, which is the humanitarian zone. So we had a real problem with staff on Tuesday, but our main issue is we are the last standing hospital in the south of Gaza. The European Gaza Hospital was taken on Wednesday of last week. And the only other hospitals around us are field hospitals. So there's some good field hospitals. There's the UK Med, ICRC, MSF Belgium. There's also the Jordanian and the Kuwait hospital. But they are all tents. These are all tent hospitals that don't have any ICU capacity, and they don't have any generated oxygen. The only standing hospital around us is the Palestinian Red Cross Society, but that's part tents, and that, again, doesn't have an ICU, and it can't generate its own oxygen. So if Nasser closes, we have a huge issue on our hands, because we have an adult ICU and a pediatric ICU, and we have nowhere to send these patients. Anyone here at the moment that's dependent on oxygen is also at risk. If Nasser closes, hundreds of patients will die.
Let me ask you, Dr. Rose, if news of what's happening in the outside world is coming to you, in a moment we're going to talk to the former Labour leader of Britain, Jeremy Corbyn, but the fact that Israel's staunchest allies, UK, your own country, where the Prime Minister Starmer has said that the suffering of the innocent children being bombed again is utterly intolerable, and we're going to speak with an EU representative where the European Union is also putting pressure on Israel. Does that make a difference? And what are you ultimately calling for?
It has made a difference. It does feel like finally our voices are being heard. But it is a shame that it comes so late. And I think we need a little bit more action than what we're seeing. Really, what we need is an end to this enforced blockade. As I said, we haven't had any aid or any food in since the 2nd of March. And the 9 trucks that came in yesterday are still parked in Israeli territory in Gaza, and the Palestinian trucks have not been allowed to pick them up. So it's really dire. I think we need to put the politics aside here. It's a humanitarian crisis, and Israel has got to open the borders to let food in, to let medical aid in, and to let aid workers in. And then you need to let us work safely.
I want to thank you, Dr. Victoria Rose, for being with us. British senior plastic and reconstructive surgeon with the National Health Service has been on 3 medical missions to Gaza since October 2023. My final question is, your colleagues and yourself, why do you put yourself in this incredibly dangerous situation where hundreds of health workers, doctors, nurses have been killed, have been imprisoned?
It's difficult to understand unless you come here and see the difference that you make. We always worry when we come here that we might not be of any use, that we might get all our kit confiscated, that we might not have a hospital to go to. But what we always say is the main thing is to come here to bear witness, because you're not seeing what I'm seeing, because there's been a complete block to all media. So I'm here, number one, to bear witness. Number two, I'm here to stand with my colleagues. And these are people that I worked with before this war started. And every time I come, they are so pleased to see me. And they need a break. And I'm an extra pair of hands. And it makes a huge difference. And thirdly, it's one case at a time. But I'm definitely making a difference. And I know we've saved some lives.
Dr. Victoria Rose, I want to thank you so much for joining us from Khan Yunis in Gaza. Khan Yunis, the second largest city in the Gaza Strip. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at how criticism of Israel is growing in Europe as the UK pauses trade talks and the EU reviews its relationship with Israel. Then we'll go to South Africa, a day after the South African president meets with President Trump at the Oval Office, and President Trump charges white genocide, as the president of South Africa says that's a conspiracy theory that's not true. Stay with us.
I've been thinking about greed.
Greed is a poison rising in the land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops at work and never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping. Greed's biggest snare. I've been trying to think about how to talk about greed.
Greed by Sweet Honey in the Rock in our Democracy Now! Firehouse studios years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to look at how criticism of Israel is growing in Europe as the UK pauses trade talks and the EU reviews its relationship with Israel. This is British Prime Minister Keir Starmer speaking Tuesday.
But first, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to say something about the horrific situation in Gaza, where the level of suffering, innocent children being bombed again, is utterly intolerable. The recent announcement that Israel will allow a basic quantity of food into Gaza, a basic quantity, is totally and utterly inadequate. So we must coordinate our response, because this war has gone on for far too long. We cannot allow the people of Gaza to starve.
Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, long an ally of Israel. The British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, also condemned Israel's actions in Gaza in a speech to the House of Commons.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, end this blockade now and let the aid in. Regrettably, Madam Deputy Speaker, despite our efforts, this Israeli government's egregious actions and rhetoric have continued. They are isolating Israel from its friends and partners around the world, undermining the interests of the Israeli people, and damaging the image of the State of Israel in the eyes of the world. Therefore, today, I'm announcing that we have suspended negotiations with this Israeli government on a new free trade agreement.
The comments of the British Foreign Secretary and Prime Minister came days after as many as 500,000 people took part in a massive march for Palestine in London to mark the 77th anniversary of the Nakba. Meanwhile, the European Union has announced it's reviewing its relationship with Israel.
We're joined now by two guests. From Brussels, Lynn Boylan is with us, Irish member of the European Parliament, chair of the European Parliament's delegation for relations with Palestine. And joining us from London, British MP, former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. Welcome back to Democracy Now, MP Corbyn, if you could start off by responding to the shift. We just were in Gaza talking to a British doctor who's there helping the children and the people of Gaza, saying that what Keir Starmer has done does make a difference. Now, you were certainly opposed to the prime minister and so much of the support of Israel. What is causing the shift in the British government's position?
It's pretty clear that the huge demonstrations in Britain and the outpouring of public condemnation of Israel's bombardment of Gaza has eventually forced the British government into a slightly different position, in that they've now suspended, as you reported, the trade talks with Israel. They claim to have suspended all arms supplies to Israel, but we question that because we believe that parts for the F-35 jets are still being sold to Israel. And we're also questioning the amount of arms that have been sold over the last few months. But there's no doubt that the position of the Palestinian people being starved to death, bombed to death in Gaza, has forced the British government into a different position. We are keeping up all the pressure we can in order to get aid in, but also to end the occupation, because that is clearly what the ICJ position is: end the occupation of Gaza and of the West Bank.
Well, let's bring in Lynn Boylan. Lynn, you are a member of European Parliament. Could you talk about, and also chair of the European Parliament's delegation for relations with Palestine, if you could talk about the significance of this review? The European Union is, of course, Israel's largest trading partner. But what do you think could come of this review, given that there is no unanimous position within the European Union on Israel?
Well, I think first and foremost, I'd echo what Jeremy is saying, is that the only reason why the EU has announced this review, and there isn't even a majority at the EU Council level to review the trading agreement, is because of the people power and the pressure that is coming on politicians right across the European Union. And I'd encourage people to continue to do that. But I would say that the time for a review is long since passed. So what we're calling for is to suspend the agreement pending the review. The review can take place. They can do the research. If they haven't seen what everybody has seen on their phone, is that Israel is not opposing human rights and Article 2 of the trading agreement. It should be suspended. But we're calling for them to suspend it, then carry out your review and come back with your findings. But what we're fearing is that the announcing a review is like kicking it down the road. It's, I suppose, addressing the people pressure, but actually not doing anything concrete to address the situation. So we're also calling on MEPs right across Europe who are frustrated by the lack of European-wide action to call on their national governments to end trade with Israel. For example, in Ireland, we have what's called the Occupied Territories Bill, which would cease trade, obviously, just with the occupied territories, but it would be a significant message sent out that at least Ireland wants to be compliant with international law. And we're encouraging MEPs across Europe to do similar initiatives in their countries.
And so, Jeremy Corbyn, if you could talk about what sanctions the UK has already imposed on Israel and against whom, and talk about the new inquiry. You've been calling for a new inquiry into Britain's relationship with Israel. If you could tell us what that's about.
Sure. On June the 4th, I'm introducing a private member's bill into the House of Commons calling for an independent inquiry into the whole process of policy making in relation to Gaza, the West Bank, and Britain's arms supplies to Israel, particularly during the period since October 2023. This is similar to the inquiry that was headed by Sir John Chilcot eventually to inquire into policy making surrounding the Iraq war. My purpose in doing this is because the government has obfuscated on many, many occasions over the past 18 months over the level of arms supplies, over trade, over aid, over credits and so on to Israel, and also particularly about the manufacture of Israeli weapons in Britain, particularly in Sheffield and other places where parts with the F-35 are made. So a group of us in Parliament have been raising this consistently. The issue of arms supplies goes something like this. Britain was and remains to some extent a supplier of arms to Israel. David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, suspended 30 arms licenses out of 300 that were in operation without ever specifying what these 30 licenses were. And to be honest, I still don't know what those 30 arms licenses are. He claims they were oversupply of weapons that could be used for crimes against humanity. But we later discovered that many weapons have continued to be supplied. And yesterday we published a report from Progressive International and other groups, which is outlining the whole case for suspending arms supplies and pointing out the dishonesty of the British government over the past 18 months on this. And that report is being circulated to MPs and will be part of the case I'll be making to the British Parliament on June the 4th. The question of suspending the trade talks is an interesting one and a very interesting development, because to some extent it is running in tandem and parallel, rather, with what the European Union is doing, because Britain is no longer a member of the European Union. We welcome that suspension. There has always been the legal case against buying settlement goods because of the illegality of the settlements, but it has been very hard to trace what are settlement goods and what isn't. But actually, a consumer boycott is gathering pace. The members of the Cooperative Society, a very big retailer in Britain with a huge membership base across the whole country, voted by 70% last week to request their board to suspend all purchases from Israel, so no Israeli products would be stocked in co-op shops. And there's a lot of pressure on to the other big retailers to do the same. So there's been an enormous shift in public opinion, and it's caused by utter revulsion at seeing emaciated children starve to death or dying on the operating theatre where there's no anaesthetics or even antiseptics to treat their terrible conditions they're suffering. People can stomach no longer the sight of Palestinian children being starved and murdered by the Israeli occupation of Gaza.
MP Corbyn, the UK sanctioned violent West Bank settlers, but the British Foreign Minister Lammy stopped short of targeting Israeli officials. Can you talk about the significance of those sanctions and what you think has to go further?
The sanctions themselves against individual violent settlers are important and a good step forward. So far, the only sanctions apply to Benjamin Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, who have arrest warrants out from the International Criminal Court, and Britain, as a signatory to the Rome Convention, is required to carry out those arrest warrants should either of those individuals turn up in UK territory. What David Lammy stopped short of doing was what many of us requested, which is a wider sanctioning of officials in the Israeli government who've been a party to the decision making on the bombardment of Gaza. Their names are well known, but also of Israeli Defense Force High Command, who are also obviously very much part of the decision making process on which buildings to bomb and which buildings blow up. Not that there's many buildings left in Gaza that are still to be blown up. And so we are continuing that pressure. So there's a big move in Parliament on military equipment, on demanding aid get in rapidly to Gaza, and also sanctions against Israeli officials. And so changes are happening, but it's desperately slow, and already over 60,000 have died in Gaza.
Can I also ask you about your response to what happened in Washington? All these young embassy and consular staffers from different consulates and organizations gathered at the Jewish Museum, and young men opened fire, killing two of those who worked at the Israeli embassy. Your response?
It's absolutely shocking. Nobody should be shot. Nobody should be killed at any event anywhere around the world. That is not the way to solve the issue. And so we have to be resolute in demanding peace for all, and also recognize that in the case of Britain and also in the case of the USA, the big demonstrations in support of the Palestinian people are of Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, and people of no particular faith. And one of the biggest groups on our demonstrations in support of the Palestinian people is actually the Jewish bloc.
Lynn Boylan, finally, before we end, if you could also respond to events here in Washington, D.C., the killing of these two Israeli embassy staffers, and then the fact that within the EU, it's France that's leading efforts for the official recognition of Palestine. If you could talk about the significance of that, France meeting Saudi Arabia next month, apparently in New York. Foreign Secretary Lamy has said he's also in talks with France and Saudi Arabia about officially recognizing Palestine. Please.
Yeah, and just to echo, I suppose, what Jeremy has said, and send my condolences to the family of the two who were shot dead last night. Nobody should be losing their lives. What we want to see is peace. We want to have a long-standing peace in Gaza, in Palestine, for the Palestinian people and Jewish people to be able to live in peace. In regards to President Macron and leading the case for the recognition of the state of Palestine, it is very welcome. Ireland and Spain recognised Palestine, I think it was about a year ago, you know, Sweden some years before. It is important. It's a really significant step, and I'm sure it would be very much welcomed by the Palestinian people. But for me, the urgency within the EU now is ending the blockade, is demanding the ceasefire. And demanding the ceasefire means that EU countries need to stop supplying weapons to Israel. So while Jeremy was talking about Britain's role in arming Israel, we have countries within the EU who are significant weapons providers to the Israeli state. If they wanted this conflict and this war and genocide to end tomorrow, then they need to stop supplying weapons to Israel. And the F-35s is a critical part of that. We also need to see the aid getting in, and the aid needs to be delivered and supported through UNRWA. And we're fighting very hard back at any push to militarize the aid agenda. And we're seeing Israel talking about setting up compounds where, you know, women would have to go to areas, putting themselves in vulnerable positions, people with disabilities, children having to go, and that Israel would decide who is deserving and who isn't deserving of aid. This cannot be tolerated. What we need is UNRWA to be allowed to do their job, lift the blockade, let the trucks in, and deliver the aid to the people who so desperately need it. Those children, 14,000 children who are at risk of dying from starvation in the next 48 hours, that's where our focus should be. Absolutely recognise the state of Palestine, but right now the people of Palestine need food, they need medicine, they need water, and they need to stop the bombs dropping on them.
Lynn Boylan, we want to thank you for being with us from Brussels, Irish member of the European Parliament, MEP, and chair of the European Parliament's Delegation for Relations with Palestine. And we want to thank Jeremy Corbyn in London, member of the British Parliament, former Labour Party leader there. Next up, we go to South Africa, day after the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, met with President Trump at the Oval Office, calmly rejecting Trump's false claims of a white genocide in South Africa. Back in 20 seconds.
And now I see the wind blowing from northwest, and I hear those honkers again. Quest overlords valley, I roll like a
vagabond.
The late, great Michael Hurley performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. To see our interview with him and more songs, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa visited the White House Wednesday, where President Trump used their joint Oval Office appearance to push false claims that white Afrikaner farmers are facing a genocide. During an extraordinary confrontation broadcast on live TV, Trump had the lights dimmed and ordered video clips played showing people calling for violence against white farmers in South Africa. This is President Ramaphosa and Trump responding to a reporter's question before Trump started playing the video.
What will it take from you for you to be convinced that there's no white genocide in South Africa?
Well, I can answer that for the president. It's for him. No, seriously.
I'd rather have him answer.
Yeah, I'd rather answer. It will be.
Our president will respond to you.
Yeah, let me.
Thank you, Mr. President.
It will take President Trump listening to the voices of South Africans, some of whom are his good friends, like those who are here. When we have talks between us on the quiet, around a quiet table, it will take President Trump to listen to them. I'm not going to be repeating what I've been saying. I would say if there was Afrikaner farmer genocide, I can bet you these three gentlemen would not be here, including my Minister of Agriculture. He would not be with me. So it will take him, President Trump, listening to their stories, to their perspective. That is the answer to your question.
But Mr. President, I must say that we have, wait. We have thousands of stories talking about it.
Sure.
And we have documentaries, we have news stories. And that, is Natalie here, somebody here to turn that? I could show you a couple of things. And I would, it has to be responded to.
Yeah, sure,
we have. Let me see the articles, please, if you would. And turn the lights down. Turn the lights down and just put this on. It's right behind you.
As the video played, President Trump falsely claimed there is a place in South Africa with 1,000 graves of white farmers.
Now, this is very bad. These are burial sites right here. Burial sites. Over 1,000. Of white farmers, and those cars are lined up to pay love on a Sunday morning. Each one of those white things you see is a cross, and there's approximately 1,000 of them. They're all white farmers, the family of white farmers, and those cars aren't driving. They're stopped there to pay respects to their family member who was killed. And it's a terrible sight. I've never seen anything like it.
The video President Trump was talking about did not actually show any real graves. They were mock graves, part of a protest against farm violence. South African police data show farm murders comprised less than 0.2% of South African murders between October and December of last year. This month, the Trump administration granted refugee status to a group of white South Africans, even as it suspended refugee resettlement for almost everyone else in the world. Trump's claims of white genocide come after South Africa brought a case at the International Court of Justice in The Hague accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza, where Palestinian officials say Israeli attacks have killed over 61,000 people. And one of his closest advisors, Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, is also from South Africa and is part of that group of people pushing these theories. For more, we go to Johannesburg, South Africa, where we're joined by Lebohang Peko. She is senior research fellow and political economist at Trade Collective Works, founding fellow at the Thabo Mbeki School of Governance at the University of South Africa. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you respond to the spectacle in the Oval Office yesterday?
So, yeah, thanks, Amy. The whole spectacle that we saw yesterday is really in keeping with the narrative of this white genocide, but it's a convenient myth, especially in the context of a declining empire. So this is a sort of white supremacist tactic, which is aware that its days are numbered, and it's kind of trying to concoct and invent imagined threats to galvanize support and to galvanize sympathy. And I think I'm very wary of the notion of even calling it white victimhood, because I consider it an act of aggression, an act of aggressive white malice, in fact. And what this does is that the velocity of media amplification, as well as the endorsements by billionaires like, as you mentioned, Elon Musk and the few other prominent former South Africans who, by bizarre coincidence, have congregated around the Trump administration, and perhaps it's not coincidental at all, like Peter Thiel, like Joel Pollack, and a few others, is that they have then exported their sense of white grievance. So these are grievances that have been around since the post-1994 dispensation in pockets, but nobody takes them really, really seriously, and they're seen as spurious, apartheid, nostalgic sentiments. And what has happened, of course, in the last few months with the ascendancy of people like Elon Musk and Joel Pollack, and their proximity to somebody like Donald Trump, who seems to have a great appetite for these spurious white supremacist ideologies, is that they mirror his own extremely skewed worldview, and of course his own racial tendencies, and they've amplified their power, their velocity, their financial muscle, have given them the ability to amplify this. And we see this, of course, that Elon Musk has used Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it this week, to amplify some very problematic and extremely dangerous propaganda.
And also, if you could talk overall of the steps the Trump administration has taken against South Africa since it came into office. I mean, this is just one aspect of it. Secretary of State Marco Rubio skipping a G20 meeting earlier this year, claiming that South Africa is what he called the present government's anti-Americanism, he said. Trump has also stopped foreign aid to South Africa and set 30% reciprocal tariffs in April, though now that has been paused for a 90-day review.
So these, the tariffs are, of course, universal. We know that Donald Trump went on this tariff spree a few weeks ago, and that South Africa was but one of many recipients of that unfortunate trade aggression. The other thing is that, of course, we should be mindful that the use of tariffs in this regard is really, not only is it aggressive, it's also extraneous. It is actually outside the World Trade Organization regulations. And even though I am no sponsor and no praising of the World Trade Organization, I think in and of itself is a imbalanced neocolonial instrument. It has to be said that it has brought into that the behavior of Donald Trump and the Trump administration towards South Africa and towards the global economic architecture in recent weeks and months illustrates that this kind of maverick John Wayne approach that he seems to be taking, and that it's really trying to hark back to some sort of an old Western style. It's just like watching an old Western movie unfold. And when you mention, the aggression that's taken place against South Africa recently, I think what's also quite interesting and that many of us are noting is the mirroring and the resonance between the grievance of whiteness in this country and the grievances, the invented grievances that people like Donald Trump are inventing, this notion that there's replacement theory and so forth. I think in material terms, South Africa is actually relatively wealthy. The way, of course, that we sometimes distribute our funds and spend our resources, a conversation for another day. But as a country, we're actually quite wealthy. And I think that this is what it pains many of us, that we had to be placed in a situation, or we chose to be placed in a situation of having to almost apologize for ourselves and to defend spurious and absolutely toxic lies.
Lebang, I wanted to read you Naomi Klein's quote: staging a show and tell about a fake genocide during a real genocide to the government that's done the most to seek justice for that real genocide is designed to break our brains. They know what they are doing. Your final comments is even the 59 refugees who came, one of them has been researched, sending out and retweeting anti-Semitic comments against Jews. And of course, we know about Elon Musk, South African, who did the Heil Hitler salute.
So, I mean, the 59 so-called, I think we should be cautious. I mean, 59, 49, we should be cautious of calling them refugees, firstly, because it certainly cheapens the many displaced people across the world who are truly unable to return to their countries for fear of persecution and killing. Secondly, I think that we need to dispose of the idea that all Afrikaners are farmers. They are not. Thirdly, we also need to dispose of the idea that only Afrikaners work this land. And I think that the way that their farming expertise has been centered is deeply offensive. The farm workers, the thousands of farm workers who die often at the hands of farm owners, white farm owners, is an absolutely underrepresented and underspoken phenomena in this whole scenario. And I think that we should also reimagine what a multilateral world would look like if it decentered this kind of white malice, and if it actually decentered these manufactured convenient truths that people like Trump and his ilk are spewing. And we can also see that there's this resonance across the world. It's not just the United States, it's Italy, it's Germany, it's the United Kingdom, and so on. And I think quietness in general is in crisis, and it's responding with great vindictiveness and toxicity.
Lebohang Pekwa, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Senior Research Fellow in Political.
Cheating man, found a no.